How are we, Ryan?
Doing well. Doing well. How are you, James?
I'm doing really good. Right. It's tax time.
Yeah, always fun.
You know, getting 2 months in.
Yeah, a lot of questions, you know, a lot of activity in the client world. So that's good. Everybody's getting their taxes done.
Getting their documents. We won't bore you with a tax podcast.
No,
but
no. We will not do that. Exactly. February, though.
With it being said, we got to look at February.
29 days this year. 29 days in the world. Yeah, got an extra day. We just covered that the groundhog saw a shadow early spring.
You know, however that works.
So that
doesn't mean a ton.
Means nothing to your portfolio. So, I mean, how are we going to dwell on that, right?
What does mean something to our portfolio, what did the market do?
Well, you'd be happy for Stockland.
Yeah.
The S&P 500, top 500 companies in the U.S. as measured by market capitalization, so size, 5.34% to the upside in 1 month.
Not a bad month.
Not a bad month at all. Now, bond investors languished a bit. If you look at the aggregate bond index, which is a basket of bonds, you saw actually a small pullback to the tune of down 1.41%. And remember that bonds respond to interest rate volatility. And we've seen quite a bit of that recently. You know, we'll get into this a little bit more. But inflation has not left the building yet.
No.
And so, again, inflation will be a main driver of those interest rate moves. So, again, it was a little bit tougher for bonds. But don't worry. Equities held it up.
Held it up for us. If we're looking at, you know, and I think for people that have like watched and listened to our podcast over the months and even years now, you know, we've slowly started to get a little more into more, not specific portfolios for every single client, but maybe portfolio thoughts in general.
Yeah.
So I guess let's take a look at our portfolio you know, not everybody's the same, but the philosophy, the thought process, it is similar. You know, I mean, what do we think about portfolios if we wanted to just kind of give an update on how we look at them?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the things you and I really wanted to blend into this podcast is really we express a lot of our feelings on things, but how are those being expressed in portfolios?
Right.
So this idea of liquidity, I mean, what are you doing with that? What are you doing with interest rate volatility? Mm-hmm. So and it doesn't have to be a real in-depth dive, but what you've got to think about right now from a portfolio standpoint is where's that liquidity flowing?
Yeah.
You know, what are the attributes of the current capital market infrastructure and what is our best allocations for clients' scarce resources, which is their assets, you know? So you got to think about when you're looking in bond world, you want to protect yourself from interest rate volatility. And there are certain ways that we would do that. But what you're trying to avoid right now are these long-dated bonds with a tremendous amount of duration. Because what ends up happening with that is duration is a study of how volatile will a bond be when interest rates move around. Well, if we know that interest rates are turbulent, given we're trying to fight this inflation that is still present in our economy, we know that there's going to be interest rate volatility there. So we right now would rather have our volatility coming from the stock component of your portfolio. So if we can tone down that interest rate volatility from the bond sleeve of the portfolio, we can actually have a little bit more equity exposure, a little more stock exposure, and keep that volatility to a light roar. And you're always looking for what's the potential payoff for the unit of risk that I'm taking. And you're just not seeing it in bond world right now. That may very well change when you start to think about interest rates being cut. And there's a lot of talk about that, but we've got our feelings on that. We'll get to that a little later. But that then allows you to be a little bit more tactical in the bond or in the stock sleeve of your portfolio. Remember, this is a capital market that is rich with liquidity. And that liquidity is, it's, I guess, for lack of a better explanation, kind of like zombie money. I mean, it enters the economy and flows to, quite frankly, the biggest stocks out there.
Yeah.
So right now, you want the largest stocks out there right here in the U.S. Emerging markets are looking a little bit attractive here. You got to be careful of China, I think. You know, that's another one of those volatile spaces. But anyway, you're really focusing in the stock sleeve of the portfolio on you know, large, well-established U.S. companies, allowing that money to come in, that liquidity to come in and find their home in the biggest places. Now, that might concentrate some of these positions and But that's okay,
right,
if we're watching them.
Yeah.
And again, what you're trying to do is maximize the potential payoff for the unit of risk that you're taking. So we'll flesh this out a little bit more as a different, you know, through the year, quite
right,
frankly, with podcasts. But this will now be a staple in the podcast.
Yeah.
What are we doing with portfolios?
Yeah, what does it look like?
Yep.
You know, you said it really well. We always try to, we try to tell clients, you know, we want to make sure you're getting paid properly for the risk that you're taking.
Correct.
Right.
And there's a science to it.
Yeah. So we talked about what the S&P did, you know, in February,
yeah,
you know, back when our podcast was going, you know, back in 2021, you know, when it was a little higher, you know, at one point, and then 2022 happened. But if we look right now, the S&P 500 is pretty close to an all-time high, or maybe you hit it.
Oh, yeah.
Right,
no, we're all-time high. We're there.
Yeah.
We're in it. We're in it now. And that's tremendous, and it's a very good nod to the strength and durability of this move.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we were bumping up against all-time highs, and then when you finally break through and then give yourself a sanity check and don't go back below,
yeah. You
know, that right there is starting to say that you're getting what are called higher lows.
Yeah.
And, you know, short-term, certainly,
yeah,
but the durability above that prior high, mm-hmm, really can give you some confidence that investors are liking this market.
I was just going to say, so it hits an all-time high, but if we actually take a look at how it's value, you know, what's the value of, or the valuation, you know, you mentioned sanity check a second ago for being all-time high. What's the sanity check on just the valuations of the market?
Yeah, it's a great question because, you know, it's like, well, what do you, when you invest in the S&P 500, let's say, mm-hmm, which is, by the way, a very large position in client portfolios that we manage.
Right.
And you can't invest it directly in an index, but there's proxies out there.
Yeah.
So I'd hate to get in trouble with compliance here.
Right.
But the bottom line is, what are you buying?
Too late.
Yeah, right, really. But anyway, what are you buying? You know, you're buying 500 companies, let's say,
right,
you know, generally speaking. And then so you say, okay, well, what am I paying for those relative to the earnings that they're generating?
No.
So the price should be somewhat in line with how profitable these companies are or aren't. So if I'm going to buy a business that's wildly profitable, I'll pay up for it, quite frankly. But in that moment, what you're trying to do is say, am I paying too much for something relative to the earnings or not enough? Anyway, so when you look right now at the valuations, they're a little bit stretched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from a relative perspective, relative historical perspective. But think about it like this. This iWatch that I've got here, I let's just say I paid $200 for it.
Right.
Overnight, you know, I wake up the next morning, somebody tells me that's worth $220. And I go, well, there are no new features to it. There's no,
right,
like, why is it worth more? Well, it's not that the iWatch got more valuable. It's that the dollar that buys it depreciated. So now it takes more dollars. So I think one of the things that you can look at with current valuations is a lot of the movement that we're seeing might be due to dollar weakness. We'll touch this, I'm sure, a little bit later, but think about how much money we're spending as a nation. I mean, the statistics are mind-blowing.
Right.
They're hard to comprehend. And again, so it's not that the And now replace the Apple iWatch with, you pick the company.
Company, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
After all, when you buy a stock, you own the business.
Right, piece of it.
Right. So how many dollars does it take to buy that business? Well, the dollar depreciates against it. Well, it takes more dollars. That's why stocks are a tremendous hedge, mm-hmm, against inflation. So anyway, I digress.
Well, and as we look through those S&Ps, and we'll get into kind of like that debt and some of that other conversation in a couple minutes. But before we get to that, one of the things, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, maybe why the S&P might start to see that valuation changing a little bit is something I know a lot of our clients have asked us about, or we definitely see it, you know, on the different headlines on the internet and the newspaper, but the Magnificent Seven.
Oh, yeah.
Or do I own the Magnificent Seven? Or should I buy the Magnificent Seven? What is the Magnificent Seven?
Right.
Or is it only five now? You know what I mean? It's February.
How about four?
Maybe. Yeah. But what is it? You know, how do we look at it? What do we think about it?
Yeah. So I touched on earlier just this idea that you want to be in the biggest places to capture that liquidity just splurge. So the Magnificent Seven are essentially the largest seven companies out there that you can invest in. And we'll, you know, when you're looking at them, obviously they've been coined the Magnificent Seven, but really three have fallen off, are in some pretty challenging territory. So I'd say, you know, just be careful with that. But the Magnificent Seven, if you own the S&P 500, trust me, you own plenty.
You got part of it,
But you know, are those drivers of perhaps maybe a little richer valuation out there? Perhaps. But yet again, when you start to think about potential for future revenue growth and things, that's how you could make the case for, well, okay, fine. Maybe right now valuations are a little stretched, but it's like buying my five-year-old son hockey skates, and you know this. Right. I'm going to sneak a couple extra sizes in there because I don't want to buy them again next year, right? So we'll just see how I can keep the blisters.
Fine.
Yeah, keep the blisters off his feet, but let's not hit Dad's pocketbook too much.
Right.
So,
have fun with that.
Yeah.
I'll start saving shares for
you. Yeah, that'd be nice.
Well, we talked a little bit about debt and the dollar and different things and, you know, looking at kind of moving away from the S&P, but actually looking more at like commodities and Bitcoin. And again, looking at these topics in the news that we see. Yeah. Right. I mean, where are we at with commodities? What are we doing with commodities?
Well, let's give the people what they want to hear. Bitcoin, right?
I'm gonna say that.
We really haven't touched that a whole lot, but I think it's time. I think it's time that we get into that a little bit. And we lumped it into that commodity space because that's really what it is. I mean, you got to be, and I think that it's more of a rules based. That's what it is, where it's like, what would be the largest allocation in a portfolio to Bitcoin? It should follow kind of that the same rules that you would have with commodities. We're not saying that it is exactly a commodity, but it gets lumped into the basket when you're thinking about allocating in a portfolio. But let's just focus in on that. I think that you'll find just commodities in general, let's say Dr. Copper, you know, as you start to see perhaps the Chinese economy come back online, if that happens, I mean, you know, again, as you start to see Europe exiting recessionary environment and maybe getting into expansion, some of the, you know, India, again, you will see a demand for things like copper, you know, even silver ends up being truly a use case commodity. But we'll leave that one there. Let's talk about Bitcoin because that's moving. That's moving. And I think that we can both agree that you don't have to have a concept of how you're going to go spend a Bitcoin for it to be something you're thinking about as a place to invest your money, right?
Yeah.
Not that you have to ever feel as if you would go and transact with this thing, right? But what it is a ledger system, okay? And I think why it's attractive as a ledger system is this. Let's just back out a little bit and say, well, the U.S. dollar is the ledger system that I use. Well, okay, yeah, I agree. I do too.
Right.
To a degree. And what you're doing is saying, if I have a dollar in my hand, I performed a service or I exchanged a good for that dollar. That dollar is holding place for me and I get to go spend it for a good or service at a future date. It's a ledger system.
Yeah.
The problem is we've got a government who, the last statistic that I read, and again, fact check me, I guess, but I'm not going to say that I read it somewhere. Every 100 days, we're spending $1 trillion from a deficit standpoint in 2024. Now, there's still a lot of time left in the year, so that'll change a little bit.
Yeah.
But think about that. I mean, deficit spending is essentially the creation of new dollars. So when you're thinking about that ledger system, I just exchanged a good or a service, and I'm kind of like losing ground as I hold that thing till I go and spend it in the future. So you could say gold ledger system. You know, I don't lump gold in that commodities basket. I view gold as a currency.
Right.
So, okay. But then now Bitcoin. This is where I think the buy-in comes. Society, and whether you agree or not, doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
global society has adopted this as a ledger system.
Mm-hmm.
I've exchanged a good or a service for this asset, and I will go, and the theory is that no more will be created.
No.
There is a finite amount of these things. So it's happening. The adoption is real. The SEC has greenlit Bitcoin ETFs. Yeah. And, you know, you're starting to see our industry giving recommendation on 1-3% of your portfolio should be in it. We're, you know, we would, you would have to, as a client, specifically ask for that from us. Yeah. And we can do it. But, you know, again, I think as we evaluate what is really the source of this liquidity that's driving this market higher is the exact reason why Bitcoin is doing what it's doing right now. So I hope that that kind of makes sense to everyone out there.
Yeah, it's a good conversation because we've kind of touched on it here and there. But, you know, that actually really kind of opens it up to, you know, what's going on and right. maybe it's moving the way that it is.
Sure.
Now, you've also touched on this a couple times, and I think it's something we got to talk about with the debt and the spending.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then also, you know, our GDP and how our economy is growing. So right. what's that relationship?
Yeah. Well, and this was a conversation you and I were right. having one morning talking about, you know, there are efficiencies in monetary and fiscal policy that you're trying to achieve. So, for instance, when it comes to deficit spending, the goal would be to have a dollar of deficit and get a dollar 20 of GDP. That's what you're trying to do. But economic study would tell you there's a point at which you spend a dollar in deficit and find a diminishing amount of GDP growth. And usually it happens when you've got a massive, your debt is a very large percentage of your GDP.
So I'm not getting as much out of the dollar that I'm borrowing.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And so, you know, at what point do you reach that limit?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like we're there. I mean, when you really do the studies, it feels, you know, so it's concerning, quite frankly. And when you look at that relationship, it just goes to show that probably some fiscal austerity, we wouldn't like that. Yeah. Wouldn't be good for the market.
Right.
But it probably, for our kids, makes a little bit of sense. But, you know, in the meantime, as our government continues to spend, you know, with running this fiscal deficit, mm-hmm. it will end up in your portfolio. And that's why we've got to be in the right places to capture that. I would tell you, we haven't touched on this in a while, but remember M2 money supply,
yeah.
right? So recognize that the lag that comes with M2 could be 2-3 years.
Yeah.
But that's probably one of the main drivers that you would use to forecast what the economy looks out 2-3 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody's got access to Federal Reserve data, and it's not hard, go look up M2 money supply and look at what has happened here in the last 18 to 24 months, and then go back and kind of say, well, what was happening 2-3 years ago? That's what's playing out right now. So as much as these ratios with debt to GDP and stuff matter,
right.
I'd also say take a look at the money supply because that's a couple plays down the road.
Yeah.
And maybe not even plays, a couple games down the road.
Right.
But all of these ivory tower economic theories, I think, have a place in the strategy that we're looking at going mm-hmm. forward.
Well, I think that's why we're kind of adding that portfolio kind of review update into the conversation because it's important for you to know where we're coming from.
Yeah.
And even, you know, as we look ahead, you know, I know we got some politics stuff coming up and everything else that's going on. But, you know, we'll make sure, you know, that we kind of review some of these different things.
When you say politics and stuff, are you talking about a presidential election?
I don't know. I mean, it's only February, right? So we got months, but
we'll leave the politics.
We don't want to pretend like it didn't exist, but no. Right. We'll keep looking ahead. And Ryan, I know we're looking at a few things, you know, coming in March and we'll be here for it.
Well, and one thing that before we wrap, I did, you know, you get a lot of questions about, okay, well, how does the market typically go in an election year?
Yeah.
And I'd say, I don't know. I mean, every election cycle is different. And I would say this one, I think it would be very hard to see a tremendous amount of volatility in the markets, you know, big pullbacks and things leading up to the election.
Right.
But, you know, we will see and we will start touching a little bit more as we get closer.
But thank you for joining us. Always enjoy these conversations. We've just kind of taken them from the morning, but we'll see everybody in a month.
Sounds great.
Right, thanks.